Okay, continuing with the song of the Thatched Hermitage. We left off at the lines, "Whether it's destroyed or not, the host originally abides, not dwelling south or north, east or west." So whether our Zazen practice is destroyed or not, whether our perfect setting for calming the mind is destroyed or not, the host, our true nature, this ordinary awareness itself, originally abides. So if our Zazen gets really noisy and seems to be destroyed, the host, the source of Zazen, the space of awareness that's hosting our practice, originally abides. And someone pointed out to me that this line, not dwelling south or north, east or west, all four of these directions appear in Shuto's earlier poem, the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and equality, which was probably written earlier in Shuto's life. So this may be a kind of reference to that earlier poem. That poem says, "The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east, from India to China." And though people's faculties may be sharp or dull, that's kind of like those are middle or low capacity. Though people's faculties may be keen or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. So here it's Shuto saying, this host that's originally abiding doesn't dwell in any location, doesn't dwell south or north, east or west. But also, this host, Buddha nature, doesn't dwell in India or China. It doesn't make distinctions between these countries and locations. And it's the same for the northern and southern ancestors of Zen, referring to the early northern and southern schools of Zen practice, who sometimes critiqued each other. And so in the harmony of difference and equality, our great ancestor is saying there are no northern or southern ancestors. And here, too, we could take the host originally abides, not dwelling south or north, as everyone equally shares this Buddha nature. So thank you for that point. It's a good one. With a supreme foundation, it's strong and secure. So here we're talking about the thatched hut of Zazen. Our Zazen practice has a supreme foundation. On the relative level, we could say the supreme foundation of our Zazen is this lotus posture. Our legs arranged in whatever way is comfortable and steady and creates the foundation for our upper body to breathe fully and let go. So the relative foundation of Zazen is our lower body and legs crossed or however we are sitting. We want to create a strong foundation for the physical posture of Zazen. And on a more ultimate level, we could say the supreme foundation of this Zazen hut is the ground of reality, vast emptiness, or Buddha nature, unlocated Buddha nature is really the supreme foundation, strong and secure, unshakable. And based on this ground of reality, we can practice. A bright window beneath the green pines. So we can imagine that this thatched hut, when it's dark outside, has a bright window under the trees, letting in the light, shining out the light. I live in Bright Window Hermitage, which is named partly after this poem and partly after this term bright window in Zen, once referred to the study hall, the place in the Chinese Zen monastery where the assembly would study the records of the ancestors and these thousands of words and explanations of the ancestors are studied in the Bright Window Hall, named poetically Bright Window, partly because it had a skylight so you could read in the days before electricity, and partly because that's the place where our minds are illuminated by the brightness of the teachings. So all of that may be packed into this image of the thatched hut with a bright window beneath the green pines. And also, if it's referring to our Zazen practice, our Zazen has these bright windows. Our sense gates are like windows, and they're all open during Zazen. We leave our eyes open, our ears open, our nose open. So these windows let the brightness, we could say, enter, or we could say that the brightness of the world is revealed through these sense gates, these windows, as our ancient ancestor Lin Ji said, there's a true person of no position, moving in and out through the gates, the windows of our face, constantly moving in and out through the windows of our face. If you haven't seen this true person, look, look. So our Zazen practice is as a stable foundation, and it's like one big bright window or five bright windows illuminating the entire world. Jade palaces and vermilion towers can't compare with it. So this simple thatched hut of Zazen is much more magnificent and awesome than even these the emperor's jade palace and these elegant vermilion towers that seem so elegant on the surface. But compared to Zazen, the simple thatched hut of Zazen, nothing compares with that. Covered with a robe, having put the myriad matters to rest. So we might say our Zazen practice is covered with a robe, and maybe implying that this thatched hut is also covered with a robe-like roof. It may be covered with a tarp if the thatch is leaking. It does have this character for robe. It's not the usual word for that we use for Zen robes, but something like this, the top or the head covered with a robe. Having put the myriad matters to rest, so this is like calm abiding, this thatched hut of Zazen. First we let go of the 10,000 affairs of our life, put the myriad matters to rest. We let go of the past and the future, which is mostly where the myriad matters stir things up, and let them go and just rest in the present, in this grass hut. At such a time, this mountain monk doesn't understand a thing. So we might say, well, isn't it our Zazen practice all about understanding how things are? But in this case, Zazen referring to not grasping any reference points, not understanding a thing. No thing can be conceptually grasped. No reference point of east, west, north, south can be held on to. So when we put the myriad matters to rest at such a time, this mountain monk doesn't understand a thing. I can't get a hold of anything. And that is true freedom. That is true non-conceptual understanding, we might say. Abiding in this hut, one no longer strives to get free. Just resting in Zazen, we don't need to look for some other freedom. Truly deeply resting in the host, this present ordinary awareness that's not coming and going, ever present, always at peace. This host, when we are verifying the host while abiding in the hut, there's no need to strive for any further freedom. This is freedom. Our true nature is complete. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? So, in this thatched hut of Zazen, why would we try to invite distracting guests in, trying to entice unnecessary thoughts in? So this reminds me of Suzuki Roshi's great saying that in Zazen, leave your front and back door open. All the guests are welcome to enter, but don't serve them tea. A great description of Zazen. Leave your front and back door open. Nothing's blocked. All your senses wide open. Everything open and unblocked. So guests naturally then wander in, but don't serve them tea. In other words, don't proudly arrange seats trying to entice them to sit down and chat with you. It's enough that they can come in, but when they see that there's no tea available, they just get bored and leave. So this is how we can practice Zazen. Guests are welcome, but we don't need to proudly arrange the seats trying to entice them in and then serving them tea and having long conversations during Zazen. Thoughts are invited or welcome. Maybe invited is a little bit too strong. They're welcome to enter and they're welcome to go. We don't serve tea to our thoughts or try to entice them to sit down and stay in this thatched hut. Maybe after Zazen, we can have some tea and chat. Then this next line is the summary, we might say, of the whole poem. Turn the light around and shine it back, thus immediately return. So this turn the light around and shine it back in Japanese is Ekko Henjo, a classic Zazen instruction. Literally means turn the light and shine it back, reverse illumination. And this phrase, Ekko Henjo, has been used by many, many Chinese and Japanese and Korean Zen ancestors over the centuries. And looking into the origin of these terms a little bit, when searching the Chinese canon for these characters, it looks like the first use of the term Henjo, which means like shine back. We're talking about the light of awareness shining back onto itself. The first time Henjo was used, I think, is in the third Zen ancestor's Song of the Trusting Mind, the Xin Xin Ming, where he says something like, "To return to the root is to find the meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. At the moment of shining back, Henjo, there is going beyond appearance and emptiness." So this is the source, the root of awareness itself, shining back onto itself. So usually the awareness, our ordinary mind, this ever-present, unlocated awareness, seems to be narrowed down into a narrow beam of attention. We might say attention is when the unlocated field or space of awareness is channeled through a beam of focus onto a particular object. So if we're attending to a particular sight or sound or smell or taste or tactile sensation or thought or emotion, we're attending to them, we're directing our awareness into a kind of a directed beam of light that's shining on this object of experience. We might say in its nature that beam of light is just this inconceivable, ungraspable, spacious field of awareness, but it seems to be narrowed down when it's directed towards an object. So this instruction to turn the light around and shine it back, the beam of light of attention that's directed outwards towards an object, turn that around and shine it back onto itself. So sometimes when we hear this, we think, well, we should direct that beam, we should bend the beam of attention back onto awareness itself. But it's not really like that. That becomes frustrating to try to do that. It's more like releasing the beam of attention or widening the beam of attention that's directed at an object. In other words, release the focus on the external object, and that beam of attention can kind of become wider and wider. It's like a focused camera lens that's directed towards this particular point, opening the aperture, widening and widening to the widest angle lens, where it's includes the entire periphery and also behind us. So here we're not talking about a visual beam. We're talking about a mind beam of attention, widening the beam of attention by releasing the focus on the object, so that what seems like a beam of attention now is just widening and dispersing into the unlocated, boundless space of awareness itself. That's my understanding of how we turn the light around and shine it back. It's not bending a beam of attention. It's letting go of the narrow focus and relaxing into the spaciousness of ever-present awareness. And I think the best way to practice, the easiest way to relate to this practice called turning the light around, is to simply ask this question: is awareness present? And ask it in a way that we're looking to answer the question: is awareness present? In order to answer the question, we have to release the narrow beam of focused attention on the object and relax into the space of awareness that's not out in front of us, where the beam of attention is usually directed forward in front of us. That's why we say, shine it back, turn around and shine it back. It's not literally behind us, but it's not in front. We relax the frontally directed attention, relaxed into the unlocated space all around called awareness itself, before it's narrowed into a beam of attention. Turn the light around and shine it back. So if the third Zen ancestor's poem, the Xin Xin Ming, is the first time this phrase Hensho, shining back, is used, it seems like, according to my studies looking into it, it looks like the first time this phrase Ekko Hensho, to turn the light around and shine it back, the first time this phrase is used is this poem, Shuto's Song of the Thatched Hut. Turn the light around and shine it back. Thus, just immediately return, I think is another way of saying, turn the light around and shine it back. Immediately return to the source of who we are through this practice. And then after Shuto, many other Zen ancestors use this phrase, Ekko Hensho, like Linji, some centuries later, or a century maybe later, Linji said, you must right now turn the light around and shine it back, Ekko Hensho, and not go seeking somewhere else. Then you will understand that in your body and mind, you're no different from the ancestors and Buddhas, and there's nothing else you have to do. That's how Linji used used this phrase. Yuan Wu, so he's one who put together the Blue Cliff Record, wrote the commentaries that we call the Blue Cliff Record. He, in one of his Zen letters, said, this is like in the 12th century now in China, the most important thing is for people of great faculties and sharp wisdom to turn the light around and shine it back, Ekko Hensho, and clearly awaken to this mind before a single thought is born. So there he kind of comments on, this is what it is. Turn the light around and shine it back. And as our poem here says, and thus immediately return, Yuan Wu says, and thus clearly awaken to this mind before a single thought is born, before it's directed into a beam of attention. Yuan Wu also says, go directly to your personal being in the field of the five aggregates. Turn the light around and shine it back. You yourself, in your experience, in the field of the five aggregates, in the midst of this life, turn the light around and shine it back. Your true nature is clear and still, and thus empty through and accept it. When you clearly see this true nature is mind, and this mind is true nature. It's called the ever-abiding fundamental source. So this is how Yuan Wu speaks of turning the light around and shining back. And our Cao Dong, Soto, Chinese ancestor Hong Zhi, poetically says, take the backward step and directly reach the middle of the circle from where the light issues forth. So there he's not using exactly the phrase Echo Hensho, but it's very similar. Take the backward step, like turning the light back, directly reach the middle of the circle, of the sphere, from which the light shines forth. And maybe one of the most explanatory comments, kind of really defining what this Echo Hensho means. Long Shi Dao Long, this is a Linji ancestor teacher who came to Japan right around the time of Dogen Zenji. He lived during the same time as Dogen. And he's talking about this phrase. He says, what is Echo Hensho? What is turning the light around and shining back? Illuminating outward things, one's own light is turned back to shine on the inner self. The knowing mind is the light. Errant thoughts are shadows. The light illumining things is called shining. And when the mind and thoughts do not range over things, but are turned toward the original nature, this is called turning the light around and shining back. It's also called panoramic illumination. Illumining the whole of the immediate essence, it's where neither delusion nor enlightenment have ever appeared. So this is Lang Xi's treatise on Zazen. You can find that in Thomas Cleary's compilation called The Original Face. And then I think many of you know Dogen Zenji in his universal recommendation for Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi. He talks about Zazen using this phrase, Echo Hensho. He says, stop the intellectual activity of pursuing words and learn the backward step of turning the light around and shining back. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will manifest. So I hear this as equating turning the light around and shining back is dropping off body and mind, dropping off the usual body and mind that we're relating to as objects with our attention focused on objective experience. When we turn the light around and shine it back by learning this backward step, at this time, our usual habitual body and mind drop away, and our original face, the host, will manifest. So these are some uses of many, many times that Zen ancestors use this phrase, Echo Hensho. But the first was, it seems like the first was in this poem, Song of the Thatched Hermitage. The Korean teacher, Chinul, who also lived around the same time as Dogen Zenji, he was really into this phrase too, and there's a whole book of his teachings called Tracing Back the Radiance. So that's Robert Boswell, the translator's way of translating Echo Henshō. Instead of turning the light around and shining back, he says, he calls it tracing back the radiance, which has the advantage of not getting us into this idea that it's like bending our attention backwards. It's more like tracing back the outward-directed radiance of awareness, tracing it back to its source. So, instead of proudly arranging seats, trying to entice external guests in to serve them tea, instead turn the light around and shine it back, thus immediately return. The vast spiritual source can't be turned towards or away from. So, when we shine the light back, what do we find? The host. Ordinary mind, this ever-present awareness, unlocated. That's why we can't actually turn towards the source, because it would have to be located to turn towards it. And we can't turn away from it, because it would have to be located to turn away from it. This is quite similar to, and maybe even obliquely referring to Dongshan's Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, or describing this jewel mirror awareness, another way of talking about the host. Dongshan says, turning away and touching are both wrong. If you try to turn away from this mirror awareness, that's wrong. And if you try to touch it, or turn towards it, or grasp it, that's wrong. So, well, I guess it's more like Dongshan would be referring to this poem, because this poem is earlier. The vast spiritual source can't be turned towards or away from. These are really wonderful and subtle Zazen instructions for those abiding in the grass hut of Zazen. Shine the light of awareness back onto itself. Just simply be aware of being aware, and don't try to grasp it, and don't think that you're somewhere else. Don't turn towards it or away from it. We can't escape it. We can't lose it, and we also can't find it. But we can wholeheartedly be this present awareness, free from the coming and going afflictions of our habitual dualistic thoughts and perceptions. So Shirto continues, meet the ancestral teachers, be intimate with their instructions. That's what we're doing here. We're meeting him, that ancestor Shirto, through his instructions called Song of the Thatched Hermitage. And we're savoring them line by line, these instructions, so we can really be intimate with them. And over again, we can keep remembering the instructions of the ancestors to turn the light around and shine it back. Become more and more intimate with such instructions. Bind thatch to build a hut and don't give up. So we might feel like this is Zazen practice is too hard and it's too uncomfortable and I don't really know what I'm doing. But keep collecting the ingredients for Zazen, collecting this thatch called comfortable posture, sitting upright, being present, letting go of thoughts, leaving the front and back door open, Everything is allowed, but don't serve tea to the guests. This is all the thatch that's building the hut of Zazen and binding it all together into this one Zazen. And don't give up. It's easy to give up. Many people sit Zazen even for many years and at some point feel like, I'm not getting anywhere, and they give up. So he's encouraging us. There's something very precious here that's closer to us than our own eyebrows. So, and it's right here, easy to discover in the thatched hut. It's always present, but when we bind the thatch together into this practice of Zazen, then it just seems to be relatively easier to verify the host within the hut. Let go of 100 years and abide freely everywhere. So 100 years is kind of the span of a human life, a nice long life. But we might hear this as maybe this poem was written near the end of Shirto's life. We could take it that way, that when this hut was first built, the thatch was fresh, and now it's falling apart and need to be rethatched. Particularly if we take the hut as the body, it sounds like the body is like really falling apart. It needs to be rethatched. It's time for a new body. We could hear the poem like that and then hear it at near the end. Let go of this 100-year lifespan. Let go of this personal life and abide freely everywhere. As the host, we don't need to identify with this lifespan of 100-year maximum lifespan of this personal body and mind, historical life. We can let go of this one and trust and abide freely as our true nature, the host, which is everywhere because it's unlocated. With the wave of a hand, immediately go without fault. So I think Taigen's translation says, open your hands, instead of with the wave of a hand. So, I think you could put it either way. It looks like maybe this is a more common way of translating this, like the wave of a hand, which kind of has the sense of, again, letting go of this body of 100 years. Kind of at the end of one's life, it could have that flavor. With the wave of a hand, immediately go without fault. It's time to leave this old fallen down thatched hut, this old broke down palace of a body, and go immediately without any regrets, without any holding on to any faults or shame. Innocent, let go into everywhere, freely. Release our limited identity into the host. We don't have to, of course, wait for our death to practice this anytime. Abiding in the thatched hut, this temporary practice of Zazen, we can release our grip on the identity, our identification with this body and thoughts. And with the wave of a hand, just go. Thousands of words, myriad explanations, are only to free you from obscurations. So all these words and explanations of the ancestors are just skillful means. And they're helpful. Skillful means is how the Buddhas benefit beings. We don't need to learn a bunch of knowledge for its own sake. All these words and Dharma teachings are only, ideally, only to free us from obscurations. We might say that essentially Zen practice is all about just seeing through obscurations. In other words, the host, our Buddha nature, is completely free already. Nothing needs to be improved or added to it. It's already complete and free and not bound by time or space or anything. But it seems to be temporarily obscured by our habitual thoughts and feelings and dualistic consciousness. So this is how the Buddha nature teachings speak of the progression of practice is not gaining anything or improving anything. It's simply letting go of whatever obscures our true nature. And letting it go is also not getting rid of, we might say, even more accurately, or a more non-dual way to speak about freeing ourselves from obscurations, is to simply see through the obscurations. It's not like we actually have to stop conceptual dualistic consciousness. We just have to see through it, see what it is, and see that the true nature of dualistic consciousness is, in fact, non-dual awareness. The very nature of our habitual painful patterns is, when seen very clearly, actually just the host itself. The nature, the true nature of obscurations is the unobscured source, the boundless light of awareness itself. And finally, the punchline, the wonderful punchline, maybe it's lines that get quoted by other Zen ancestors more than any others in this poem. If you want to know the deathless person in the hut, how could it be separate from the skin bag here and now? If you want to know the deathless person, the unborn, deathless person, meaning the host abiding in the hut, the deathless person, our true nature, that at the end of 100 years actually doesn't die, because this one was never born in the first place. And if you want to know this deathless person, because that's the true freedom from birth and death, is to know the deathless person in our zazen, in this falling down, propped up zazen that may or may not be destroyed by time and impermanence. If you want to know the deathless one, that's the source of this hut, how could it be separate from this skin bag here and now? Skin bag is just one of those Zen ways of talking about this body. This body's kind of like a bag of skin that's like filled with all these organs, intestines and livers and hearts and bones and so on. It's a sort of a way of saying, let's not get too attached to this body. It's a bag of skin. But many people might have thought that to know the deathless person, we have to separate from this body and mind, because it's not this body and mind. So here, the non-dual punchline, in order to know the deathless person in the hut, how could it be separate from this body and mind experience? Here and now. Don't try to find it somewhere else. It's maybe not quite right to say, this body and mind itself, this skin bag is the deathless host. We might then not notice how free and unlocated the source is. But once we've clarified that this deathless source doesn't dwell anywhere, isn't bound by time and space, and yet it's ever present and very ordinary, this present awareness. Once we've clarified this to some extent, then we can see that everything we're experiencing in the relative world, starting with this skin bag, this body, these senses, this coming and going impermanent experience, is the pure manifestation, the pure expression of the deathless host. How could it be otherwise? There's nothing that's not the host. The awareness is expressing itself as this particular thought, this particular feeling, this particular bodily sensation, this particular color and sound. When we look for a color and a sound, what we really find, if we intimately investigate the sound that we're listening to now, we can come to verify that this sound is actually nothing more than hearing. It's the activity of hearing that we call sound, that we label as this thing called sound. Really, we can't find any sound in addition to hearing. You can explore this during Zazen. See if you can find a thing called a sound in addition to the activity of hearing. And then the hearing. Is it not the case that hearing is a type of knowing? It's a type of awareness. A particular dimension of awareness or knowing called hearing. So in that way, tracing back the radiance further and further, we find there's just this one ungraspable, empty, bright presence of awareness, and it's constantly expressing itself as hearing and seeing and sensing. And then we then label this activity of seeing and hearing and sensing as color and sound and body, skin bag. But the skin bag is itself just an expression of the deathless person. How could it be separate? Emptiness itself is form. Not the slightest separation or distinction. This is true non-duality. So, this is the Zazen instruction here. To turn the light around and shine it back, thus immediately return to the host in the hut that doesn't dwell in any direction or location, and then come to see that this deathless person in the hut, this unlocated host, is not in the least bit separate from this skin bag, this present experience here and now. One undivided, ever-present suchness. And so that concludes the Song of the Thatched Hermitage. And it's a wonderful poetic poem to chant or recite and to become intimate with these instructions by going over it again and again. And this is one of our lineage poems, one of our lineage ancestors expressing how to practice Zazen in this way. And I think you can find the influence of this poem in the later ancestors like Dongshan's Song of the Dual Mirror Awareness and Dogen Zenji's teachings of Zazen. So thank you, and please enjoy the grass hut and the host that originally abides. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.